unthinkable. Right? But we'll meet again on Thursday, and then I just post an exercise on plan that's due Sunday at 11:59. Okay? Okay, so let's take a look at First McCullough. What I actually want to do is I want to go through Jolly and then loop back to Texas and Overton. So that's what I decided to do. Let's take on Jolly, then we'll loop back and finish up Overton. So I need someone to give me like the awesome facts, like Miss McGee. Jolly, what happens?
There is a
And who did he sue?
He sued the council.
So anybody able to translate to out of British? So who's the council?
Yeah,
the city council. It's like their public-owned flats. What do Americans call them? Public housing? Right, so it's public housing. It's the green, grassy play area in a public housing development. That's where this boat is. So the council owns the development, including where this boat is dumped. Okay. What does the trial judge conclude? Liability, no liability? Liability. Isn't it partly this kid's fault? So what does the trial judge say? Contributory negligence, so he actually discounts the plaintiff's recovery by 25%. He said at least a quarter of the kid's fault, so we're going to discount it. So we're going to try and put the kids aside because we've already chopped off his 25%. Okay, this is being tried to a judge. Would that happen in the wonderful country of America? No, right? In America, proximate cause goes to the jury. So note one tells you, in Britain, we abolished the jury trial. We invented it, but we got rid of it in many cases. But in the States, proximate cause goes to the jury. All as the note says, judges are a little bit more aggressive in taking proximate cause from juries because it's so hard and we're so superior as lawyers. Or for whatever reason, although it's an element for the jury, you see judges intervening more often. Okay. I want to make sure we have all the regular elements before we get into proximate cause. So, what's the injury? That's not the injury. He's a paraplegic. So injury equals the plaintiff is paralyzed. Okay? How about duty? Why does the trial court, or where does the trial court find a duty? I'll continue my reign of terror along that line. Miss Hayden. So where does the trial court find duty?
In the Occupiers' Liability Act.
Right, so in Britain there's actually a statute called the Occupiers' Liability Act. And what duty does it impose on the occupier or landowner?
Common duty of care.
What duty of care? Ordinary care. Regime just imposes a reasonable duty of care. Did you work out who the duty was owed to? If you look at the end of that first section, 2.2, to those who are. That's who's owing the duty. Who do they owe it to? People who are. How are they on it? So what would we call them? Licensees and invitees. So in Britain, the statute actually says, hey, you owe reasonable care to both. In fact, you don't need to write this down because it's Britain and you never need to go there, okay? But so notice the British statute says you owe a duty of reasonable care to both invitees and licensees. See that? What kind of duty is there towards children? Or when we describe the duty, what does the statute say about kids?
So if you look at 2.3, oh, they have to be prepared for children to be less careful.
are involved because they don't exercise the same amount of care for themselves. So if you have something on your land which attracts kids, you have to exercise more care because children exercise less care for their resources. Okay, that's British. Let's do American. So if you were working through duty, is the plaintiff's duty easy or hard here? Is the duty we're trying to impose on the what duty are we trying to impose on the defendant? The duty of a? Okay, how are we going to get a duty? No, how are we even going to say there is a duty? They're landowner. This is a premises liability case, right? Everybody see it? It's not that they, like, shoved a boat on top of him, right? Or ran over him or anything. We're suing him because they're suing the council because of the conditions of the land. So this is actually a premises liability case. Okay, I'm going to open it up for offers. What status does the kid have, do you think? So presuming we're in a traditional state, what status is he? He looks like he might be a trespasser, right? No permission to be on the land. And they don't want to sneak him up to a licensee if they... Permission, do you think you got express permission? So what might you argue for? Why might you get implied permission? Because kids play there all the time, right? So, but what duty under America do we owe to trespassers and implied licensees? Do we owe reasonable care? Only to not willful or wanted. So it looks as if the little kid's losing in America because he doesn't even get through duty. Everyone solve the duty riddle. I heard it. Yes? Which you need what for? A kid. Okay. Not the kid. Okay. Anyone remember anything about attractive nuisance? Yeah?
And then I would be attracted to a kid. You got to, I guess, warn them or.
That's the duty that's going to come out. What comes out? But what do we have to get there for to get into that attractive nuisance box? That's the conclusion that you're coming out of. We have to. So far you've just got a kid, and I'm like, you don't get attractive nuisance just with a kid. Yes. There's a dangerous artificial condition, is there? Which is? There's a boat. Excellent. Anything else? Yep. Occupier has to foresee that.
The
condition could pose a threat to children. Can we meet that?
Yes.
How can they foresee kids?
Bingo.
So we can meet all the criteria for attractive visits. So we went to Prime Minister's liability. We thought they were trespasser, but now we're playing with attractive nuisance, and we think we've met the criteria. So the question is, if attractive nuisance applies, what duty is owed to the child? The duty of reasonable care. So we're back out of reasonable care in America. We had to work harder, but we're back out of reasonable care. Everybody see what we did? We had to get that duty. Okay. Breach. Do you think they breached?
Yes.
So what should they have done? Yep.
Remove
the boat. Remove the boat. So their breach was that they didn't remove the boat. Okay, now, that was a walking through high street analysis of breach. In other words, if you come in off the thing, you go, oh, these idiots should remove the boat. Okay, remember in breach, we're meant to actually do two steps, right? We're meant to refine the standard of care, refine what ordinary care means, and then we're meant to do some kind of analysis, a risk-utility analysis of the breach. Correct? We're guessing they should have removed the boat, but to really convince you, you have to do that more detailed analysis. Anyone refine the standard of care? So ordinary care, reasonable care for the council here, physical, mental circumstances. So try this. Why should they have removed the boat?
Well, there's loads of rotten things in my yard.
Yep.
Because a reasonable person would have foreseen that it would cause a problem or cause a barrier.
the risk if you took it away, but
why are they, how are they, why are they taking it away? Like, there's loads of things on my land.
It's in a common area.
So it's in a common area, so they're responsible for it? Yeah. But what else? What makes it so clear that they should have taken it away? So they see it, they put a damage sticker on it, a danger sticker. So what have they got in terms of refining the standard? Superior physical? They have superior knowledge. Everybody see it? So we're actually asking, what is reasonable care for a council that knows it's got a dangerous boat? Okay, what else does it know? Where children play. So notice, as soon as you add that superior knowledge in, you're like, oh my goodness, it's clearly a breach, right? Would a council who knew about the dangerous boat and knew children played there, what would ordinary care, reasonable care look for with that superior knowledge? See it? Okay. Why are you so convinced they had to take it away? So if you were doing a risk utility analysis here, what is the risk? What is the utility? So let's start with the risk. What risk does the boat pose? Everybody agree? There's a risk that kids are going to get harmed. Risk equal kids hurt playing. Okay? How about the, we have to look at the alternative, which you told me is remove the boat, right? So the alternative you told me is they should remove the boat. Okay, we got to look at what that does to the risk. It's zero. Okay. But isn't it costly or expensive? What do you think?
No.
High, medium, low.
If it is, it's worth the reduced risk.
It completely erases the risk, and it looks as if they need to send two guys to lift it on what's still there.
The trailer,
attach it to the bottom of one of the council trucks, and pull it away. And did they?
No. No, they said it's 7 days, 6 weeks later.
But they never do. Our breach is you should have taken the boat. See it? And they don't remove it. And it's a pretty minimal cost. It's a minimal burden to remove it. Right? So that's why you're so convinced there's a breach. Everybody see it? There's a really high risk.
Did they say in the second instance that it would be really hard for the planes to move the boat? Or were they talking about, like, actually move the boat off or back the boat up?
No, they're talking about the plaintiffs had a difficulty because they initially tried to put it on the trailer because they're two 14-year-olds, and when they try to put it on the trailer, they make holes in the bottom of the boat.
Okay.
Right?
I thought they were good.
But don't you think the council can pretty easily send a crew out, they lift it on the trailer, they take it away? This is not a $50,000 fix to get rid of the boat.
Okay, so that's why you're so convinced there's a breach, right? Because if they leave it there, there's this really nasty risk of hurting the kids playing, and if they take it away, they eliminate the risk for relatively little cost, so you're like, of course they breached. Everybody good? Everybody agree? You good? Okay, now, put up your hand and say, I swear I will remember this in 20 minutes. You swear? You won't look at me and go, I don't know what you're talking about. Okay.
Are you going to erase it from the board?
No, it's still there and ugly, if you can work out what that means. But it means we worked out there really was a breach, right? High risk of injury to kids, minimal cost, completely eliminates. Therefore, we know we have a breach. Okay, let's do cause and fact. Was there a breach, failing to remove the boat, right? The cause and fact of the injury?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Mr. Short, utter a sentence with that in. Yeah?
Sorry.
Cause and fact, prove cause and fact.
the injury. Everybody agreed we got cause and fact. No issue. We're happy. We're running. Okay. So the only thing we have left is your new favorite inquiry, proximate cause. Okay. Anyone tell me what the trial court said, what kind of test they used, what they said. So the trial judge, Bryce, his opinion summarized 300 to 301. So if you were to summarize what the trial judge said, did he say there was proximate cause? And if so, why? What kind of terminology is he using? Yes?
His main thing was the risk was of a foreseeable type. That it's not a particular risk, but a risk of the genus. To say that a couple of 14-year-old boys, it's not guaranteed that they're going to be crushed by the boat, but that they might somehow be harmed in a way similar to this while playing with the boat.
Okay, so he uses reasonably foreseeable, and he says it's reasonably foreseeable these 14-year-olds are going to mess with the boat and be injured, therefore I find proximate cause. Okay, how about the Court of Appeals? So someone wants to tell me, so the next section summarizes what the Court of Appeals does, right? 301 to 302 summarizes what the Court of Appeals said. So what does the Court of Appeals say? Yep.
That the cause of the injury was the fact that the boys jacked it up and made it unstable, and that this type of injury was not reasonably foreseeable.
So do they think no injury is reasonably foreseeable? So you're absolutely right. They say this is not reasonably foreseeable. These 14-year-olds jacked up, fixing it is not reasonably foreseeable.
They said that injury caused by someone on the boat, falling while on the boat, playing on it, scraping a knee or whatever, all those were foreseeable, but this type was too remote.
Bingo, right? So they're using reasonably foreseeable too, and they go, hey, it was reasonably foreseeable the kids could like fall through the planks to hurt themselves, but you couldn't reasonably foresee this fixie up moving thing. Okay. Who thinks it's reasonably foreseeable? Just raise your hands, I don't have clickers. Who thinks it's not? Okay, how are we gonna decide that? Everybody see the problem with the reasonably foreseeable test? You're like, well, yes, it is foreseeable. Oh, no, it's not foreseeable. Everybody see? If you just phrase the proximate cause test as reasonably foreseeable, we're going to get into fights about foreseeability. Okay? We need to do two things. The first thing we need to do is understand what reasonable foreseeable means. And then secondly, we're going to transform it into a risk approach. Yes, it's going to be so exciting. Okay, so let's start with reasonably foreseeable. The test is not just foreseeable, right? It's got the root in it, reasonable. So anyone work out what reasonable does? When we're asking, was it reasonably foreseeable to the council, what's the R doing? What does it require us to show? What does it not require us to show? Yep.
Weird, unexpected things that could happen in between.
Right, we're not asking, could Gillis foresee it? Because I could, yeah, right? We're not asking, oh my god, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. We're having a little bar. It has to be reasonably foreseeable, because let's be honest, we can foresee anything. Right? I mean, you could foresee that Professor Corgi might come in and bring you candy. It's not going to happen, but it is foreseeable, right? Or you could foresee you're going to win the lottery. Right? But it's not reasonably foreseeable. So see, it gets rid of those weird, oh my goodness, that could happen. Right? That's not the test. Right? Because in hindsight, we're always like, oh, well, that could have happened. Right? So reasonable gives us this level to ask, yeah, but would a reasonable person think it's going to happen? See it? Reasonable foreseeability. What else does it do? Object versus subjective. Objective. Does it matter if the council foresaw it? No, because the test is, would a reasonable person foresee it? So notice it doesn't require the defendant to actually have foreseen it. Like, oh my goodness, look, that's what's going to happen. Right? We're just asking if a reasonable person would foresee it. Everybody happy? So reasonable is doing double duty. are we asking if the council could reasonably foresee exactly what happened? So when we run reasonably foreseeable, are we asking whether they could foresee exactly the manner in which it happened? Is that what we mean when we say reasonably foreseeable? They're like, oh, the tool kids are going to see it. They're going to come back 5 times. They're going to try and sail from Cornwall, right? Which is like saying, oh, I thought about Columbus and I'm going to set sail from, I don't know, San Francisco. You're like, yeah, okay. So can you foresee? So is that the test? Answering innocent?
No.
No. Okay, where does the court say that? It's a sub-rule, which is a cute sub-rule. So can anyone tell me, there's a couple places where the court says, when we apply reasonably foreseeable, we're not asking if you can foresee the precise or exact manner in which something happens. Yes?
Well, the last sentence of 302, well, the third paragraph, which says, so it's not foreseeable, or the accident was foreseeable, it is important not to consider the precise accident which occurred, but the class of accident.
Right, so we don't have to see the precise accident, we have to see the class of accidents. Very good. Anyone pick out a different place? Just if you have it in your notes, that's cool. Yep.
It must be the genus, not the particular type.
So the genus versus the particular type is a different way of saying the same thing, right? You don't have to foresee exactly the way it happens. You just have to foresee that type. Excellent. Anyone else? Are we good? You can do the bottom of 303 to 304, right? Viscount Simmons was in no way suggesting that the precise manner in which the accident occurred need to be foreseen. It was, right? You don't need to foresee the precise manner it happens. So we're asking, can you foresee that type of injury? Everybody get it? Do you have to foresee just some harm? So if we don't have to foresee the precise type, when we say reasonably foreseeable, is it enough to say, well, you could kind of foresee someone would get hurt? So is that what we mean by reasonably foreseeable? See how broad that is? Is it enough to say, oh, we can just foresee that someone might get hurt somehow? Do you think that's what it is? If that was the test, what's the problem?
Then the first half of reasonable goes away, because any kind of outcome. A meteor can fall and hit it and knock it over to hit somebody. And, well, it was foreseeable that that could happen, and it actually happened, so good enough.
So would it, if the test was really reasonably foreseeable means you can reasonably foresee any type of harm to someone, would it ever not be met? No, right? So it wouldn't function as a liability limiting device. So we're never going to simply say, oh, well, you could foresee that somehow someone might be hurt. That's not enough, right? We don't have to foresee the exact precise manner, but on the other hand, it's not enough to say we could foresee that something harmful might happen. We have to foresee that type of harm. Okay. All good? Do you have to foresee the paralysis? So another thing I think the council would argue here is, look, we could foresee a little broken leg or a boo-boo on the knee, but we couldn't foresee paralysis. That's not reasonably foreseeable. So here, see how the council's going to argue? The council's going to argue we couldn't foresee the jacking up, the rest of it, and they're like, no, you just need to foresee that type of accident. Then their second argument is we couldn't foresee the serious grave injury that we would get here, right? We could foresee maybe a scrape, maybe a broken leg, but not paralysis. Is that argument a valid one, or do the courts reject it? I don't want to try it. Yes, Mr. Fraley.
I would say that they would reject it just because, like when we're doing battery, like the eggshell rule, like taking as they are.
Excellent. So the eggshell skull roll lives over to proximate cause. So that was very good. Can you find where the court said that, though? Where does the court say that? So anyone look at the quote we were just looking at on the bottom of, is it bottom of 304 to 305?
controversy the precise matter. Nor its extent. So we're not asking if you can foresee the exact gravity of the injury. We're just asking, can you foresee that type of injury? Everybody see it? So when we ask if the injury is reasonably foreseeable, we're neither demanding that you foresee the exact manner in which it occurred, nor its extent. Everybody see that? So we've clarified what we mean by reasonable foreseeability. So the bottom of, I'm sorry, it's 303 to 304. Okay, so we're not asking the exact manner. We're not asking the extent. We're simply asking if that type of injury is reasonably foreseeable. Are we happy? We understand what reasonable foreseeability means. Yes?
I still don't understand what you mean by type of injury. You're not saying paralysis. You're
okay.
Saying just injury in general.
That's the problem.
Because injury in general, like you said, is too broad.
Right? Whereas, could you foresee that they would get a jack and shift and jack it up and then he would pull under and then it would fall? Are we asking that? No. So we're asking something in the middle, is that type of injury foreseeable? And he's like, right? What's the type? Exactly. Congratulations. Okay, now. That's exactly the problem with the foreseeability approach, right? Because it's an unmoored inquiry into what's reasonably foreseeable. So to answer your question, we are going to bravely go to note 5. Oh, good. So now we're going to learn the scope of the risk rule, right? Not because we say the old courts do this, but because we say it might help Mr. Lateef with his question. No. Okay. So go ahead and tell me what you get the risk roll as lots of different flavors. And I want to say I read the note and the one I liked was what? Okay, because I said pay special attention to this note, so I'm hoping that you colored something in this note. Yes, Ms. Craig, which one did you like?
An actor's liability is limited to those harms that result from the risks that make the actor's conduct tortious.
Which is the third restatement, right? So an actor's liability is limited to those harms that result from the risk that made the actor's conduct tortious. Or the book says you can restate the third restatement as whether the injury suffered by the victim is one of the harms whose risk rendered the actor's conduct careless. Okay, anyone like a different one? Okay, we'll work on, is that the one you want to work on? Okay, our problem is, what on earth does it mean? Okay, right? That's a problem. Okay, so what words, what concepts do we know we're trying to link? Injury and breach. Okay, so let's actually work on the reformulation of the third restatement. So if you look at that 309, on page 309, it says the third restatement adopts a variant because it's actually easier for you to do their restatement of it than the third restatement itself. So, the proximate cause inquiry in terms of whether the injury suffered by the victim, what's that? Injury. So it asks whether the injury suffered by the victim, i.e., plaintiff's injury, right? That's the victim. Plaintiff's injury is what? Is one of the harms whose risks rendered the actor's conduct careless. Okay, what's the other term we're looking for? Breach. Okay, they didn't use the B word. So what do they use instead of breach? The actor's conduct careless. Everybody see? Saying that the actor's conduct was careless is saying that the defendant breached. So they want us to ask whether the injury suffered by the plaintiff is one of the harms that
And they want us to say, one of the harms, whose risks, so I put that, whose risks rendered the defendant's conduct careless. And we want to say breach. Okay, so can anyone rephrase this? Is plaintiff's injury one of the harms that, or we want to use the breach word? Yep.
That made the action a breach.
Is what the plaintiff's injury one of the risks that caused us to say defendant breached? So see how it's relating injury to breach. Is the injury the plaintiff suffered one of the risks that caused us to condemn the defendant as breaching standard of care? See what it's asking? Is everybody better with what it's trying to do? So it's trying to connect the injury and the breach by saying, is plaintiff's injury one of the harms whose risks rendered the defendant's conduct careless or caused us to say there was a breach? Yeah.
So normally we do breach as connected to injury, but this is going the other way, correct? Right? The injury says that there is a breach, right?
No, but good. So, no, but good. So, let's do, apply it, and then you'll be like, oh, that's what I was saying, or that's what I think. Yes?
Can you say that phrase one more time?
Okay, well, you have to say it.
Well, okay, so I have a plaintiff's injury is one of the harms whose risk caused the breach, or no? That's where I'm stuck.
Okay, so let's do a hypo, and then I want you to be able to do it. Because once you're able to say it in your own words, you get it. It's not that I'm refusing to repeat it, because we'll get a little handout with it on. But when you go, oh, I can write it in my own terms, then you're like, oh, I get what they're trying to say. Okay, so let's right here do plaintiff's injury. What's plaintiff's injury? If you were to describe in Jolly what plaintiff's injury is, what is it? Paralysis from what? From doing what? How was he crushed by the boat?
From working on the boat.
Okay. So he tried, he has... So he has, he's crushed in fix-up. Everybody agree? Okay. That's what his injury is. He's crushed in the fixing up the boat. Everybody see it? Got it? Everybody agree? Crushed in fix-up boat. Okay, that's what it is. What do we have to ask over here, right? Is plaintiff's injury one of the harms whose risk rendered the conduct careless or made us say he breached? Okay, you ready right now? Because we're going to flip. Not 20 minutes ago, I asked you, why was there a breach? And what did you tell me? There was a breach because, and why was he supposed to take it away? Because the what? What? See what you just said? Because the risk outweighed the benefits. What risk?
The risk of injury outweighed the burden of removing the boat.
Okay, now see it? To work out breach, what did you have to know? What had you already worked out to be able to say he breached?
The benefit or the cost and benefits of having the boat there and of causing harm to a person.
So you had already identified what? A certain type of risk. Everybody see? To get breach, you had said, oh my goodness, he shouldn't do that because there's a risk. See it? You condemned his conduct as careless because you identified a certain risk. You said you got counsel must take the boat because of the risk of
injury.
injury to kids who are playing. So do you see how breach involves you identifying certain risks of harm? Are you good with that? You couldn't condemn his conduct as careless unless you thought, oh my goodness, he's risking this. This is terrible. So what does this test ask?
Is the risk that you're worried about going to be the same risk that was happening here?
Bingo! Does what happened match the risk that caused you to say he was negligent? See it? Does the injury that occur match the risk you were worried about? If it matches, should the defendant pay? If it doesn't match, then they shouldn't, because that's not why we said they breached. Yes?
Do you run into situations where you run breach as though you want to make sure that there is a lot of risk already, because you already know?
Oh, very good. So who's going to describe the risk really broadly here? Plaintiff or the counsel? And who's going to define the risk really narrowly? Okay, so if you think of it as a flashlight, so here is the breach, and it's looking into the future. What's the plaintiff going to say the risk was? Oh my goodness, you should take away the boat because of the risk of... you can't just do injury, right? Because we said you can't just say, oh, is there anything foreseeable? So what do they say? It's actually what the house of law buys into. Plaintiff's going to say it, yeah?
They said the risk was that kids would meddle with the boat in some way.
Meddle with boat in some way. So they say the reason you breach was because there was a risk that kids would meddle with the boat in some way. Is plaintiff's injury within, see how we use the phrase, within the scope of the risk created by defendant's breach? What's the answer?
Here, yes.
Because they
meddled with the boat in some way.
Bingo! Excellent! So that's what the plaintiff wants to describe it as. What would the counsel say the risk was?
That it was only foreseeable risk. Children who were drawn to the boat to climb upon it and be injured by the rotten planking that was giving beneath them.
They describe it as a play risk, right? They'd say, oh, the problem is kids are going to play on it. That's what the risk is from your breach. What is the plaintiff's injury? Is it a play risk? It's a... Right, it's a fix up the boat risk. So see the game you play, right? You have to ask yourself, is plaintiff's injury within the scope of the risk created by defendant's breach?
So you can make it go either way.
You can make it go either way. But see how it connects breach to injury. Okay, now who had a set? So what type of injury are we looking for? Right, it's whatever type of injury we see as caused us to call it a breach. Right? So you're going to argue it both ways. Do you now have a sentence?
I'm harassing you. Do you have a sentence now?
No.
Well, what was your sentence? Because you have to fix it up.
I think you went down. I said I wrote down a couple of them.
Okay, well, we'll fix it right now. What did you used to have and you had to fix? Okay, so is plaintiff's injury one of the harms? You guys complete the sentence.
That caused us to say there was a breach.
That caused us to say there was a breach. The reason we said there was a breach was because kids would meddle with boats. What happened? Meddled with a boat. Match. Done. Everybody see? So that's one way to complete the sentence. Or some courts complete it as one of the harms whose risks rendered the defendant's conduct careless. The reason we said he was careless was because of this risk, and that actually materialized. See it? Yeah.
All right, so the question is maybe irrelevant to this one because I understood why, but I was thinking of other situations. You know how we distinguish between adults and children? And here they mentioned that playing could be in terms of mimicking adults' actions. So how much emphasis does a defendant have to foresee a child acting as an adult in a situation that he would really think children wouldn't act that way? If you get what I'm kind of saying.
So you're fighting, why does the House of Lords willing to have this broad definition of risk, which includes fixing up. So why are they saying it's not just a risk that kids would climb on, it's this broader risk? Because they think...
I understood it because they're just trying to say if you have liability for an attractive nuisance, and...
Well, that's your duty breach, but why is it they're willing to describe it in a broader way? What do they think kids do?
Mimic adult action.
Mimic adult action. So they're saying, when you ask what the risk was, it was not just that they would play on it, it was also that they'd mimic adult actions and fix it up. Therefore, both those risks are foreseeable. So see it, the reason they're willing to go broad, because they think kids do really weird things.
Yeah, okay? That makes sense. I guess to me it just... Why do we have the distinction of a child then? Because if you're going to say that they could act as an adult by mimicking them, then aren't we holding every adult act and standard the same as a child? Because they mimic.
Okay, so you want to go back and say that it's not that the child's engaging in an adult activity, which is, I think, what you're going to. That's not the argument they're making. I think they're making an argument that kids play in various ways. One play is climbing on. Another play is fixing it up, and that's still play, and therefore it's within the scope of the risk.
So they're just trying to put it into even the defendant's argument of that it's a play risk. So either way, either risk you choose,
right?
It's going to be.
So you could describe this. Oh, this is just a different type of play. Therefore, it matches. There's another way to get the match. Okay. Yes.
Why don't they just say was? Plaintiff's injury, one of the harms that the breach reasonably foresaw in the formulation of the breach or something like that.
You can do that, because how do you tell what risks were rendered? You use reasonably foreseeable. Absolutely. Cha-ching. Congratulations. Yes.
I mean, they just don't give you that foresight. You know,
when they go to define what the harms are that you risk, what are they going to use? Reasonable foreseeability. So they're going to say, how do we know what was risked by your breach? Oh, what was reasonably foreseeable. Okay? But the difference is they're connecting it into the breach. Okay, let's do some easy hypos, because then you can work the flashlight. Okay, you ready? So let's do the easy hypos on note 3. Actually, let's do B. B is one of my favorites.
B.
Buffa boy. 3B. Okay. So, everybody get this one? Father returns from target practice, carelessly hands his 5-year-old son a small loaded pistol. The gun is no more heavy, sharp, or cumbersome than many toys designed for 5-year-olds. The son accidentally drops the pistol on playmate's toe, breaking it. So let's do the first one. Was F's carelessness an actual cause of P's injury? Answer? Yes, because if he doesn't give him the gun, he can't drop it. Was he a proximate cause? So you want to just go with the risk? Okay. So what's the question we have to ask? What's plaintiff's injury? Right, so we can't just say broken toe because that doesn't give us enough information for purposes of running proximate cause. So how would you describe the type of injury they suffer? A dropping injury.
already see? It's a dropping injury.
Dropping injury.
Okay. We're going to go back over to Breach. And we're going to say, why do you think he breached? The father's about to do that. And you're like, don't do that careless conduct because... Don't give the kid the gun because... The risk is what? So Breach is give kid gun. What type of risk is foreseeable? Shooting injury. What do we get? Is plaintiff's injury within the scope of the risk? The flavor of risk caused by defendant's breach. Answer? No. Okay. Are you going to change the facts?
I was going to ask, why couldn't you just broaden the breach part, like saying that the breach was that it's foreseeable that there would be an injury?
Because remember we said that's cheating.
Well, you can hurt himself with the gun.
And that's the problem. If you just say he could hurt himself with a gun in some way, you're always going to have it met, right? That's why we're not going to say, oh, could you foresee something would happen? Right? We said no. So what would it take to change the fact pattern so that this injury, see, this one is outside the scope. That's the scope of the risk that you create. You breach. And see, shining forward is this risk. And that's not in it. It's the wrong risk that materialized. What would you have to change here as the breach? Whoever wants to do it, or together.
That the gun was extremely heavy.
Bingo! Give the kid a 200-pound gun. Why should you not do that? What's the risk associated with that? Dropping injuries. Therefore, if a dropping injury materialized, you'd have to pay for it. See it? So you're tying the injury to the very risk that caused it to say he breached. Got it? Okay, let's do, yes.
What if you take the bullets out of the gun? You can't still be a dropping injury.
So, if you took the bullets out, then is there this risk? No. Now, the problem with is there a dropping is, what do the facts and the problem say? It was no heavier than that. So there's actually no problem with giving him the unloaded gun. Unless you said, oh, but the kid knew where the bullets are. In which case, your breach is probably leaving bullets lying around. Yes?
Can there be multiple risks, like the 200-pound gun with bullets?
Yes, so if you give him a 200 pounds, what, look at the scope. Oh my goodness, right? Both of them are within the scope of the risk. You'd have to pay for either one that materialized. Or if he breaks control of the bullet, comes out and hits another playmate, you'd have to pay for both of them. Excellent. So the bigger the breach, the bigger the number of injuries you have to pay for. And that's why theorists love this. Small breach, only pay for that. Big breach. Okay, can we do another one? Let's do it, because I'm running out of time. Because you'll go in 5 minutes, whether it's really exciting or not. Isn't it so exciting? Okay, let us try C. Okay, so the first thing we're going to work out is how are we going to describe the general type of injury the plaintiff suffered here? Explosion injury. Okay, so we got an explosion injury, and we want to see whether the injury suffered by the victim, plaintiff's injury, is one of the harms whose risk rendered the defendant's conduct careless, but caused us to label a breach. So what's the breach? What did you say? Oh, don't do that. Put poison on the stove. So he puts the poison can Okay, and why do you think that was a bad idea? So what risk is it that you have in mind? That what? The chef's gonna use it because it, what kind of can is it? Unlabeled can. There it is, unlabeled can. We see poison guest. Oh, let's add some of this spice. All right, okay, that's the risk we see. Can you meet proximate cause? No. Can anyone say it in a sentence? Because plaintiff's injury is... is what? Right, so you can do it, you can do it really short, is what? It's not within the scope of the risk. Everybody's eating a shorthand. No, it's not within the scope of the risk. That's a little shorthand for no, it doesn't match. Anyone do it longer? Because?
Not one of the harms whose risk caused the breach.
Not one of the harms whose risk rendered defendant's conduct careless. We're condemning his conduct because of the risk of poison, not because of the risk of fire. Everybody see the game? Isn't it awesome? Okay, good?
So there's technically a right or wrong answer. Like there's technically need to be completely wrong. It's all about interpretation. Kind of like it was a huge injury. Of course, that's way too broad.
So sometimes like this, there's a clear answer. And you're like, no, it's not the same risk. Most cases which are litigated are going to be like the Jolly case, right? Right? So what does the plaintiff in Jolly want to define the risk as? Broad or narrow? Broad, right? The plaintiff wants to say it's really broad, any boat meddling injury. The defendant wants to make the flashlight really narrow and say, oh, only playing kids, not fixing up kids. So you will more typically see cases like that where the parties are arguing about what the risk was. Okay? Yes. Whereas these examples are to make sure you see it and you go, oh no, it doesn't match. Yes?
If the can had said that it was flammable, but the restaurant owner did not know that it was flammable, even though it was on the can.
Well, then what's his breach? Putting the can there without reading it, right?
Right.
So if the can says flammable, it says flammable poison, and he puts it on the stove, what risk is he creating?
Explosions.
Both of them, right?
But it doesn't matter that he didn't know.
What's the question? Subjective or reasonably foreseeable? So it's a reasonable part.